This is episode number 28 with Kristen Ulmer. Welcome to the Rise Higher podcast. I'm your host, Stephanie Kwong, and each week I'll bring you an inspiring guest with an empowering message to help you rise higher and live your best life. Each guest shares their time of struggle and setback and what specific mindsets, tools, practices, or habits they use to overcome so that you can apply them to your life. This show is to remind you that you're not alone and that there's always a pathway up. Thanks for spending some time with me today. I'm grateful to be on this journey with you. Our struggles are a call for us to rise. So here we go. Let's dive deep now so we can rise higher together. Hello, hello, and welcome back to the Rise Higher podcast. Steph Kwong here, and today we are dropping in deep about fear. So I want you to go ahead and take a moment and just think about what your relationship with fear is. Are you afraid of fear and you either shrink back or close off when you feel it? Or is fear something that you feel you need to beat or conquer? Because if you think that fear is an emotion that you need to overcome or conquer or get rid of because it's bad, well, we're going to shake that up in today's conversation about fear with world-class athlete and fear expert Kristen Ulmer. Now, Kristen is a thought leader on fear who draws her tenure as the best woman extreme skier in the world for 12 years. And from studying Zen for 15 years, and from facilitating thousands of clients on flow and peak performance. Now, her work has been featured in such media as NPR, The New York Times, Wall Street Journal, Forbes, USA Today, and Sports Illustrated. And she's the author of The Art of Fear, Why Conquering Fear Won't Work, and What to Do Instead. And she currently teaches and keynotes about fear and anxiety all over the world. So Kristen is no stranger to fear, and for her entire career as a top extreme skier, she used fear as fuel by channeling her fear into motivation, and it made her bring her A game every time she hit the slopes. Now, Kristen used her fear as motivation, but she also repressed it, which led to major burnout in her career and PTSD. So in today's episode, we get real about the negative effects of emotional repression that it has on your life, which usually leads to really unhealthy habits that are meant to numb us from feeling what we've locked away inside. And we know that numbing is just a band-aid and it isn't actually creating the health that we need in our mind, body, and soul. And so Kristen brings a fresh perspective to see that fear isn't the problem. It's actually our reaction to it, that when we deny or push aside fear, or when we try to conquer or beat it, that ultimately it causes big problems in our lives, like chronic anxiety, indecisiveness, insomnia, panic attacks, or even depression issues. So the good thing is there's a solution, and there's a more honest and loving way to be with fear, to make peace with fear instead of allowing it to run our lives. And so today, Kristen shares how her Zen teachings helped her to realize her relationship to fear was the source of her unhappiness and anxiety, and that it was the cause of her PTSD. And she also shares how she created a new relationship with fear so that she was able to heal and resolve the problems that were being caused by her repressed fear. So some of the things that we talk about in today's episode are the importance of allowing fear to flow in and out of our bodies naturally without repressing or denying it. Why going to war with fear is going to war with yourself. Kristen's take on what fear is and its role in our lives. How to have an honest and constructive conversation with fear. How to flip the script on fear and see it not as a personal weakness, but simply as a sensation in the body. How to lovingly relate to fear so it won't take charge of your life. And Kristen's four-step Art of Fear method to processing fear as it arises. And of course, as always, so much more. So I hope you enjoy this episode with Kristen as she shares how to develop a more loving relationship with fear And for everything that we mentioned in today's episode and for links to connect with Kristen, you can check it out in the show notes. And that's over at stephaniekwong.com/EP28. Okay, here we go.
Kristen Ulmer, it is so wonderful to have you back on the Rise Higher podcast.
Better audio this time.
Way better audio. For those of you who are tuning in, Kristen and I actually did an interview probably like 4 months ago or something. It was a while back. And you were being so awesome to try to find Wi-Fi when you were in Alaska doing heli skiing. And we thought we had it down, but some way, somehow the sound was just really wonky. And so here we are again for a second take. To have you on the show. So I'm really excited that we're able to make this work. And thank you for being flexible with me.
I aim to please. Well, it's my favorite subject. I'll talk about fear, you know, at least 12 hours a day before I get tired of
it. Just 12?
Yep, that's it.
Wow. All right.
Maybe 13.
I love it. Well, Kristen, I would love for you just to open up and share. You have such a powerful story. I want to just highlight how we got connected. I know a friend had come in to, I was in a like co-working space, and she came in and she said, oh my gosh, I just listened to this podcast. It was incredible. There was this woman, Kristen Ulmer, on it. She's a fear specialist. And she has a really cool story of being, you know, you were a top skier, and it almost happened by accident. I remember when you and I spoke, you said that you had only taken up skiing because it let you out early on Wednesday if you took ski lessons, and that your parents didn't really pay attention because they were free range parents. But that ended up, you know, becoming a major passion of yours, and you really excelled in it. And then, of course, it led to where you are now. But I would love for you to share that story because it's so fascinating, and I think people would really. It'd be really interesting for them to hear how that started you into the path that you're at now.
Great starting place. Here's the reason why I'm a fear expert. Because I'm not a psychologist. I'm not a doctor. I'm not a researcher. Like, what qualifies me to be a fear specialist? Well, here's the reason. I have 30 plus years of real world, practical, in the dirt experience dealing with a tremendous amount of fear. And it started when I was a kid, mm-hmm. like you brought up, and somebody at our school came in and said, oh, there's free ski classes on Wednesday. You get out early from school. I'm like, sign me up, you know? So that started like the next, you know, 40 plus years of just obsession with first skiing and then fear. And in the middle there, I became a professional skier. And I became the best woman big mountain extreme skier actually in the world for 12 years. And what that means is that I risked my life on a pair of skis for a living. Like, I jumped off really big cliffs, through flips off of up to 70-foot cliffs. I skied you fall, you die descents. I did the first female ski descent of the Grand Teton, which is a life or death situation, and on and on and on. And I was called fearless, and the media was actually even more intrigued by my ability to just be absolutely fearless in the face of tremendous danger, sometimes on a daily basis, making life or death decisions, than they were even of the skiing itself. And I developed such a reputation of being fearless. In an industry-wide survey of the entire outdoor industry, I was voted the most fearless woman athlete in North America, beating women in all sports disciplines, not just skiing, at one point. So that was pretty cool. And the thing is, I felt fearless. And I realize now that wasn't true. But back then, it sure felt true. Like, I know what it feels like to feel fearless. And, you know, in a sport that is extremely dangerous in a man's world and all that. So I have that to draw from. That's my past.
Mm-hmm. How did you, well, what was the mindset that you had then? I know that there's a twist, right? You said that you thought you were fearless, but really, and we'll get into it, that there actually was fear there. But at that time, what do you think allowed you to be so fearless?
I was really good at, and you know the language, conquering, overcoming fear, letting go of it, ignoring fear, not being a victim to it, not letting it get the better of me. I was just really, really good at ignoring fear, I guess is the summary of it. In order to do that, I became a really rigid, stoic, arrogant, masculine person. And it sounds ideal. I mean, I became famous. I was the best in the world at something dangerous. I made a lot of money and all that. I was celebrated, and it's actually not ideal. It causes a lot of problems to do something like, especially dealing with as much fear as I was dealing with. I found that you can get away with that level of repression, we'll call it, or ignoring fear for about 10 years. And then your life just starts to come unraveled. And that's what happened to me. And so while there's a payoff for overcoming or conquering fear, or putting it out of your mind or letting it go and all those, that language, you get a moment of relief from fear, but it's at the cost of your future happiness, health, well-being, all of that. And I was just an accelerated version of that. Like, I learned the hard way what not to do about fear. And I also learned what to do about fear that I'll share with you later. So I was doing some things right by fear and I was doing some things wrong by fear, but the ignoring or repression of fear is what I was doing wrong. And after 10 years, my version of problems that came from repression of fear were PTSD, burnout, more and more injuries. Those were kind of the big three. And it got to the point where I started to hate skiing. Like I started to dread winter, which was kind of crazy. And so I quit my ski career after about 15 years. By that point, I was miserable and set out to figure out what had gone wrong. And that's what led me to the second phase of my training about fear, which is I started studying Zen and kind of ravenously studied Zen, actually. And then I started realizing very quickly that my repressive approach towards fear was causing my PTSD and the burnout and the injuries and all that. Go ahead.
And, you know, it's interesting because you really took up this sport because it allowed you to leave school early. And I want to throw this in because I thought it was just so funny when you shared this with me. But you mentioned that you skied in a pair of jeans until you were 20, right? Yeah. And you also had a pair of skis from 14 to 18 you were using that you found in a dumpster. I mean, this is just, it's just such a fascinating story to me. But when you learn to repress or just basically ignore the fear so you could become fearless, was this a choice that you made for yourself, or is this how they trained you to excel at this sport? Like, where did that come from for you to start to, you know, just basically ignore the fear?
I never actually had any formal training in skiing except for those lessons in second grade that I mentioned. And after that, I'm just completely self-taught. Like, I am the poster child for it's all mental. I didn't have any training until I made it on the U.S. ski team for moguls, which is another thing that I did with my ski career. So not only was I the best woman big mountain extreme skier in the world, but I also made it on the U.S. ski team for moguls, which are two completely different sports. And I made those two accomplishments happen 3 years after I bought my first pair of ski pants. And I'm competing against girls that were, you know, raised in high school ski academies, training their whole lives to get on the U.S. ski team. They'd had the finest coaches money can buy their whole lives. I mean, I'm an anomaly. I know that. It was an amazing, magical time for me. And so none of this I learned by coaches. What happened? Usually the repression of fear starts when we're young. And for me, it started right around age 6. And you mentioned I had free range parents. Other people start repressing fear the first time they say to mom, "Oh, I feel afraid." And mom says, "There's nothing to be afraid of." I call it fear shaming. And we do it in our, you know, almost every single parent does some version of fear shaming, especially fathers, like, you know, be a man, don't be afraid. And so it's telling that child that it's not okay to be afraid. And if I want to get mommy and daddy's love, then I need to push fear down. I call it in the basement. And for me, because I had free range parents, I just decided at age 6, because my parents had a really bad marriage and I ran away from home, you know, which really is, I just ran to the vacant lot next door and sat there and refused to leave the step until dinner was ready. But at age 6, I realized that I was just not going to be afraid of anything. And I was going to have to raise myself. I was going to have to take care of myself. And that set in motion the pathology that, yes, on the one hand, I won't say that that's the part of me that was set in motion to become the best extreme skier in the world. It was that was the moment that set on course the pathology that was eventually going to make me hate skiing and have a lot of injuries and have PTSD. So it looks like great, you know, like you're going to mess your kids up. Those of you that have kids, the key is to just mess them up in the right way that they're motivated by their pathology.
Yeah, it's inevitable. Right? You cannot avoid. Yes.
Right. Right. Anyway, that's a whole can of worms. We could keep talking about that. But I mostly want to kind of shift to the audience and their relationship with fear and let's see where we can go from here. But do you have any other questions about my ski career? Because it's kind of fun to talk about it.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think it's just nice for people to hear your backstory, which is why I wanted to share that. So it leads you into where you are now, because many of the listeners, they've gone through hardships. This is part of the reason why they want to listen is, you know, hearing stories of struggle and setback and what they did to rise higher and overcome, because if they've gone through it themselves, one, they know they're not alone. And two, they can start to see, especially from so many of the stories of my guests who've been on, that what happened to them is actually a catalyst for many people's purposes now, currently, right, in their life of what they're sharing, or has had a huge impact for what they created down the road. And so that's why, again, I wanted to highlight more of your past to let people just see where you were to where you are now. But we can shift gears. I mean, I know that there you had a point in time where everything changed when the PTSD really did kick in for you and you did start to hate skiing. Do you want to share about that?
Yes, absolutely. PTSD. So I saw a lot of friends die in the mountains. I saw a lot of friends get crippled for life. I had well over 50 near-death experiences during my ski career. And what PTSD is when you go through a difficult emotional experience and you don't know how to deal with the negative emotions properly, well, what do? You push them down, you know, into the basement, you lock the door, you throw away the key. And then you seemingly don't have to deal with them. Maybe you go numb in the face of them. You just ignore them. What happens, though, is those... Well, let me give you an analogy. There's two ways that I see that we can live our lives. And I imagine like you have a house full of children. And half your children you've named love, joy, gratitude, forgiveness. The other half of your children you name fear, anger, despair, sadness. Despite your best intention, could you treat the children all the same way? Typically, no. And so what we tend to do, the first way to live our lives, and I think that Rise Higher audience will definitely resonate with this, where we tend to nurture and love and show off to the world the lovely children. Love, joy, gratitude practice is big in America right now. Forgiveness practice, all of that.
And we show those off because that's when we know we'll get love back in some way, right? Because if we show those other parts, our parents will punish us or go like, we don't like those parts of you, so tuck them away in the basement, as you said, but only highlight the ones that would essentially get us love in some way when we were children.
Right. Like, don't be afraid. Or if you're sad, turn that frown upside down. Or we don't do anger, all of that. And so the first way to live your life is to nurture and love and show off to the world these wonderful children. And then what do? With the other children, we lock them in the basement and we throw away the key. The second way to live your life is actually what Zen is. I think a lot of people think that the first way that I just outlined is Zen, like to be all filled with love and joy and peace and forgiveness, that's perceived as being Zen. It's actually not. That's very New Agey. It's very Christian, you know, Mormon, that kind of thing. So it's definitely the predominant religions in our culture cultivate that kind of approach. Zen is very old, and it's about seeing the wisdom in all that life has to offer. It's about also loving and nurturing and taking into consideration those quote, negative children like fear, anger, sadness, despair, and giving them some love too. And I know that Rise Higher is about self-love. And we tend to think, oh, choose love over fear. But if you don't have love for fear, you know, because fear is such a huge part of you, it's like you love all your children except for this one. If I could just get rid of this one child, and then you abuse this child and you lock it in the basement you know, fear is such a huge part of who you are. Actually, how you treat fear is how you treat yourself. You're naturally now abusing yourself. If you hate feeling fear, you hate yourself. And it's so I'm picking out this analogy because I'm trying to talk about PTSD. And so what I did is I locked my fear, my anger, my sadness over those traumas in the basement. And I tried to just kind of be a positive person and look for the silver lining in my friends' deaths or my near-death experiences. But what's happening in the basement is those children, they're revolting and they're yelling and screaming and burning the house down, doing anything they can to get out. And they're subconsciously running my life. And that's what PTSD is. And then a lot of the treatment for PTSD is to kind of nurture the love and the joy and the gratitude and all that. And it's another way to keep those voices repressed. So what happened is after I retired from professional skiing, I kind of started to learn all this. And I realized that my severe repression of fear was causing my PTSD. And it was running my life covertly from the basement, mostly showing up as sleep issues. I also learned that it takes a tremendous amount of energy to not deal with your fear, anger, and sadness. And it was exhausting. And that was causing my burnout. Like I just had no energy left. I had to sleep like 10 hours a night just to function. And injuries. I had to become such a rigid, stoic person to not deal with my fear, anger, and sadness, in particular fear. And what do we know about rigid trees and a heavy wind? They break. Like we all kind of get that the repression of emotions is a really, really bad idea, but we don't really truly understand the association that the repression of emotions has with PTSD. For other people, it shows up as depression. For other people,
anxiety,
mm-hmm. anxiety disorders.
Or even addictions to numb out, to not feel. You want to drink or sex or drugs. Any of that TV,
opioid.
Social media even is a way to not feel. We distract with that.
Shopping.
Mm-hmm.
Cleaning, hoarding, you know, two polar opposites. Like all these things. And staying really, really busy. Mm-hmm. Like you have some friends that are just so busy, they don't have time. They don't have time to deal with their children in the basement, right? Mm-hmm. It's a way to distract ourselves. And then there's also the fear avoiders, the people that never, you know, take any risks. They just avoid any kind of emotional experience, you know, certainly fear, anger, sadness. Like nobody wants to deal with, quote, negative emotions. And we're in this culture that really supports that. You know, like even as beautiful as gratitude practice and love and forgiveness, all that is, like we see in our culture, that church where somebody came in and killed a bunch of people, 24 hours later, the church members were saying that they forgive the person that killed, you know, all these people.
Mm-hmm. It's like they bypass. I've heard the saying spiritual bypassing, right? Not avoiding the very thing that you need to really heal and deal with. And you just bypass that opportunity to dive in and grow from that and feel it and expand. And you just go straight, like you said, to like the love and the gratitude and everything happened for a reason. And there is, but you actually have to dive into the depth of the basement to explore what's there for you as well.
Exactly. And when we hear these things, we're like, oh, these people are so wonderful and it warms our hearts. But when I heard that, my heart broke because I realized that they were repressing their emotions. And I know the consequences of that. You know, next thing you know, you're driving in traffic. And there's a little bit of a backup on traffic and you're like, die, everybody, I want you to die. Like you just snap, you know, and it shows up, the repression of emotion shows up in so many different ways. You know, for me, it showed up as in the ways that I mentioned. For other people, it shows up in depression. You know, you don't think, okay, well, what's the relationship between the repression of emotions and depression? Well, depression is Latin for pressed down. And when you press down your emotions, they become depressed. And thus, so do you. It's, you know, it's to the point now in our culture where if you have some sort of problem, and it doesn't matter if it's psychological, spiritual, physical, even mental, sleep issues, and on and on and on, the repression of emotion either has everything to do with it or something to do with it on some level. Because we're such an emotionally repressed culture. Mm-hmm. I mean, all you have to do is look at the amount of antidepressants and anxiety meds that we take mm-hmm. in order to see evidence of that.
Yeah. No, it's true. I mean, so many people want to avoid the feelings, those darker feelings. But I think there's also, and I know that you have a way, and we'll share it later on, a process to actually be with those fear feelings. Because a lot of times, one, it's just unfamiliar, which is a lot of times why people don't want to deal with it. It feels unfamiliar or feels so scary, or you think that, oh my gosh, if I actually allow it to come forward, will I stay stuck there? Like, I don't know if it'll ever stop. And so there's so many, I've seen people not wanting to experience the fear because they're just uncomfortable with it. And I kind of want to share something. I know you're mentioning, you know, this podcast is about self-love. To me, self-love is not about just focusing on love and not on the fear. To me, self-love is actually embracing all parts of ourselves, willing to look at the light and the dark and to say, I love all of it versus I only love parts of me. So to me, in my definition and what I share and teach, you know, my clients is self-love is willing to love all of who you are. And again, we have been so trained to only love certain parts. Again, as a child, the parts of us that got love and validation are the ones that we continue to expose to others. Because all we want, you know, on this planet is to feel love and to feel like we're enough. And those other parts that were shamed and judged, like, let's just continue to shame and judge them because they were shamed and judged when we were younger. And that's not okay. And so, again, the self-love piece is about integrating all of that in. But I want to hear from you. What do you define fear as? Like, what is your definition of fear?
I'll tell you my definition of fear in a second because I just want to reflect on what you just said because okay. It was really well put. It is counterintuitive to give love towards your fear, give love towards your anger or sadness. You know, I like to see them as children. Mm. And, you know, we are, like I said, taught not to do that. And if we're so invested in keeping them in the basement, it's like we don't want to give up the ground that we've achieved. It's like maybe somebody has PTSD or maybe somebody has depression or anxiety disorder and they feel a little bit better, you know, because they've put fear in the basement. They don't want to give up that progress they've made to try something completely different. Mm-hmm. You know, to turn towards the darkness. Mm-hmm. But we'll get to that later. As for my definition of fear, fear we see as being very complicated. Fear is actually very, very simple. We have this amygdala, you know, two almond-sized nuggets at the top of the spine determining safe or not safe. And it's the manufacturing plant for fear. And every piece of information that comes, let's say we're like computers, that comes into our system, our computer system, is first run through the filter of, I call it the lizard brain. Seth Godin calls it that too. I got it from him. Comes through the lizard brain, determining safe or not safe. And to the lizard brain, nothing's safe. You know, everything's a crisis. Mm-hmm. And so,
isn't it?
Yeah. Okay. and so it's our kind of our primary operating system. And so it sends a shot of discomfort to the body, the amygdala does. And that's what fear is. All it is a sensation of discomfort in the body. Mm-hmm. And it's with us every single moment of every single day in nearly every single interaction we have, whether we're willing to believe it or not. I could facilitate somebody after a 9-day Vipassana retreat and it would still be there. It's always there. Even if it's nothing more than the fear of losing this amazing feeling that I have right now, you know, the second I go back home to my bad marriage or my shitty job. Can I swear on this podcast?
You just did.
Okay. So fear's with us all the time. And it's just a simple sensation of discomfort in the body. Now, we're taught that what to do about it is to try to understand it. So fear's in the body, it's an emotion in the body, and so we start to think about it. And we're also taught to control it. You know, emotional intelligence is seen as our ability to understand our emotions and control them. So we get busy, like, why do I feel this way? Well, it's an old system. It's been around fear since the first single cell amoeba, determining safe or not safe. I won't get into that. That's kind of a whole story, but and we really can't understand it. I mean, it's like trying to understand the universe, the sun, the moon, the stars. The second we understand something, it just changes anyway. So we do the next best thing, which is we judge it. And it feels terrible, so it's bad. And it's supposed to inspire fight or flight action, you know, without thought. Like in animal, there's a perceived threat, shot of fear to the body, fight or flight. With humans, because we have this whole extra step, we start thinking about it. perceived threat, shot of fear to the body. We start thinking about it and we judge it as bad. And next thing you know, we're fighting or fleeing the fear itself rather than the perceived threat.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why we're all the language is about fighting fear, conquering it, overcoming it, you know, winning
beating
the war,
it.
Beating it. Yeah. Don't let it win.
Becoming
right?
fearless, which is impossible.
Right. So I see people like in skiing, you know, they get on a steep slope and the fear shows up. And the issue is the steepness of the slope. And the fear is there to actually make them bring their A game to that experience. Like, don't mess it up. Like, you got to nail your turns because it's steep.
You might die.
But then right. And then the fear shows up and the fear is the bigger problem than the slope. Like, the slope is forgotten. The problem now is the fear. And so we not only fight or flee the fear, but we freeze in the face of it. We fidget around it. We have nervous laughter. We, you know, pull on our hair. Our leg comes bobbing.
Or our palms start to sweat. Our throat gets dry. Our body gets tight. All that
right.
too.
Right. So our reaction to fear is what's complicated, not the fear itself. And fear is not the problem in our lives. We get that wrong. It's just a simple sensation of discomfort prompting us into action. The issue that we have with fear is our reaction to fear. It's our reaction to fear that is causing problems for us, not the fear itself.
So powerful. I love that. It's such a great distinction. And I know that, you know, you have an incredible book that everybody, if you're listening, you got to get it. It's called The Art of Fear. But I know what you also teach is how people can experience fear in like a simpler, more authentic way, right? And how to transform your relationship with this feeling, the sensation in your body or with emotion. So how do you guide people in doing that?
Let me give you an example. I have a client, her name is Jaquetta, and she came to me and she was just suffering horribly. Depression, anxiety disorders, a borderline personality disorder diagnosis, was in a kind of dead-end job, suicidal, had attempted suicide a few times, and she happened to be a skier. So I started these mindset-only camps and taught Zen while skiing, about life, about skiing. And she started working with me privately aside from the skiing as well. And she was doing the thing, trying to conquer, overcome her fear. And the first thing she said to me is, this fear has to go. I've got to get rid of it. And this was supported by all her therapists and her friends and family. Like,
wow,
yes,
really?
Win that war against that anxiety, you know, 3 deep breaths, tapping, you know, positive mental imagery, all that. She was trying everything. She was contemplating taking medication because medication puts fear in the basement 10 feet below and cases it in concrete. You know, alcohol, opioids, it's like all these things we take to not feel our fear. They work, you know. But she wasn't there yet. She was desperately trying to do it without medication. She felt like that would be a failure for her. And I asked her this question, what's the definition of insanity?
You know, the same answer? Thing over and over again and expecting a different result.
Yeah. So she had spent 30 years trying to win the war against anxiety, fear, all that. It wasn't working. I said, why not try something different? And it takes a lot of effort to fight fear and it'll consume your life. It also takes effort to make friends with fear, but it's a whole lot less effort and it's a lot easier than you think, and you get a dramatically different result. And so what I helped her do is I helped her take fear out of the basement in a gentle, easeful way, have a conversation with it. You know, and the conversation went something like, fear was saying, how could you do this to me? Like, I'm going to seek vicious revenge on you if you keep this up. And I have been seeking vicious revenge and I've been winning and you cannot win this war. You know, I'm not so bad. I just deserve respect and love and consideration. And so I helped her broker a better, more honest, more considerate relationship with her fear. So for me, emotional intelligence is not our ability to control our emotions. You know, whatever you try to control winds up controlling you. You know, that is actually causing a lot of problems in our society. You know, we are at war with fear. It's just not working. If we do the exact opposite, which is relinquish control and just make friends with it and invite it into our lives as a normal, natural part of life, not a sign of personal weakness And then we learn how to feel it instead of think about it or try to understand it and have a more simplistic, kind of like animals do, relationship with it, because you can't understand it anyway. You know, just feeling it, dealing with it emotionally instead of dealing with it intellectually. Yeah. And that's what she started doing. And next thing you know, after only 6 months working together, she was no longer depressed or suicidal. And she still struggles a lot. It's been a few years now. That dead-end job that she was in, she actually just got promoted. She's been promoted over the years, and she's now a manager, and she tripled her income in just 3 years' time. It's remarkable. And it does take effort, and it's counterintuitive. But if you do it, not only do those problems lift, but all of a sudden the wisdom and the resource that is fear starts to become available mm-hmm. as well. It's like, I think, you know, gratitude practice, joy, love, forgiveness practice, great. But if you start with a fear practice first, you know, like if you clean up the basement, like you make friends with those negative children or those mm-hmm. children that we're typically avoiding, like you do that first and then have the gratitude and the love practice, you will be unstoppable.
Yeah. So how does one cultivate a fear practice?
Like I said, it's counterintuitive. And especially if somebody's very, very invested in locking fear in the basement and fighting that war and they've won a few battles with it, you know,
you can. But just a few, that's the thing. How many battles have you had? And if it's just a few, you might want to redo your strategy because you want to win them all. No.
Right. Well, it starts by owning the fact that you picked this fight. Mm-hmm. You declared war against fear, and fear is just merely retaliating. Mm-hmm. You know, it starts by changing your language around fear. The subtitle of my book, the title is The Art of Fear. My subtitle is Why Conquering Fear Won't Work and What to Do Instead. If you get nothing out of this podcast, just change your language in this one simple way and see how that changes things for you. Stop using the word fear and overcome or fear and conquer in the same sentence. We're not here to try and conquer fear. We're not here to overcome fear. We're here actually to make friends with it, to be curious about it. We're not conquering anything out there. Like I opened a flying trapeze school recently.
You did?
And people are like, oh yeah, well, it failed, but that's another story. But people would say, oh, I conquered my fear. I'm like, you didn't conquer shit, right? The whole reason why we enjoy doing things like this, flying trapeze, is because of the fear. Like, the fear is what brings excitement to the experience. Like, fear and excitement neurochemically are exactly the same thing. What they did, they didn't conquer fear. Fear, first of all, helped them conquer the situation, helped them bring their A game to it. And they did it not despite the fear, they did it because of the fear, and thus it was fun. Which brings me back to my ski career. Like, the thing that I did right by fear during my ski career, which made me the best in the world, is that I was also having a love affair with fear. Like, I really enjoyed feeling fear. And I know this is a lot of information, and it's such a big subject, and I feel like I'm talking too much.
No, this is good. This is all the information that will really support the listeners. So keep going.
Well, let me just summarize it in one just quick soundbite. The part of me that repressed the fear, it caused all sorts of problems in my life, and it was exhausting. And you can only get away with it for 10 years, and then your mm-hmm. life starts to come unraveled.
Well, I know. Just want to highlight this too. I remember from when we first recorded the podcast, you mentioned that when you actually looked underneath it, that there was more, that you were motivated by fear. Or that fear of being invisible, or the fear of not being loved, right? That was actually underneath for why you needed to achieve even more in that success in your career. But even underneath that, there was still fears that were kind of running the show in some way. Am I accurate in saying that?
Yes. And that's the second part of what I was about to say. So the part of me that repressed fear, it became my repressor. Mm. But the part of me that loved feeling fear, that merged with it, that even became intimate with it, it was totally under my radar. I mean, I was in my 20s. I had no idea this was happening. What was happening that was making me the best in the world is that I was merging with my fear. And Rise Higher is about motivation. Fear is actually one of the greatest motivators we have. My fear of not being special or invisible, of not being loved, was motivating me to be a world-class athlete. I'll tell you what, you jump off a 70-foot cliff and throw a big old front flip, everybody loves you. You are no longer invisible.
No longer.
Yeah. I loved feeling fear. I mentioned before that fear and excitement neurochemically are exact same thing. You know, my passion came from fear, my excitement, my aliveness. You know, people call people like me an adrenaline addict. Well, beneath the adrenaline is fear. I was a fear addict. I loved feeling fear. And so that love affair that I was having with it, you know, and the thing is too, because I was merging with it and becoming intimate, that fear was actually the thing that was taking me into higher states of consciousness. And so in many ways, it looked like I loved skiing, but really I loved fear. And then by merging with fear, taking me into these higher states of zone, flow, ecstasis, I was actually really addicted to that feeling. And we know that extreme sports takes people into the zone, you know, that has a reputation for doing that. Why is that? It's because of the fear. These athletes are merging with fear, becoming intimate with it, and it's taking them into the zone, and little else does. So I had a love affair with fear, mm-hmm. and that's what made me the best in the world. Now, the repression part, though, was the part that I needed to heal. And it you know, the question is, can you love and hate something at the same time? It sounds like a bit of a paradox. Like, which is it? Did I love fear? Was I merging with it? Or was I repressing it? And when you make your life all about one thing, you can do both. Anybody that's married knows that they can love and hate their time, right?
Great example.
Right. So my whole life was about fear. And yet I was called fearless and I considered myself fearless. It's not true. So that's the conclusion of my ski career. Do you have any mm-hmm. questions?
Yeah. So I would love for you to share, how does one cultivate a fear practice? Because I know you mentioned before you do all the love practices, right? Whether it's gratitude, journal, all that stuff. Start with a fear practice. How does one start and then cultivate a fear practice so that they make friends with the fear instead of trying to conquer it, destroy it, stop it, overcome it? What is a pathway for them?
Well, I'll answer that, but I got to tell you, it's been a long journey to get to this answer. 15 years since I retired as an athlete, and just to have the conversations with fear that I've had in my own life, and then, you know, I've worked with thousands of people now where I broker a conversation between them and their fear, and then I wrote the book. And I thought I knew what was up with fear before I wrote the book. And then I knew so much more afterwards. And then since even writing the book, I've learned so much. This is very new ground. And this is for warriors only. And it starts with, like I was saying before, language changer. You know, it's really, really important how you talk about fear. As long as we continue to talk about fear in a derogatory way, we don't have a chance in having a healthy, conscious, loving relationship with fear. And so that's why I say we've got to stop talking about fear in terms of conquering it or overcoming it or talking about it in any way as being a negative. So the first thing that you should do with a fear practice is, and I love to personify fear, see fear as a child in the basement that you've been abusing for 10, 20, maybe even 50 years. And, you know, how would you then make it up to that child? Would you like, okay, I'm willing to have a fear practice, and then will you shut the hell up? Or, you know, first of all, you have to start talking about it, not as, okay, I'm willing to have a fear practice so then I can quiet it down more. Like, how would you talk to that child, I guess? Maybe I'll ask you, what would you say to a child that you've just realized you've been abusing?
Oh my gosh. I mean, first I would just I'll say it to my little girl, like, you're okay. You're safe. And what do you need from me? How can I support you? You know, what how can I love you the best? And just because I think sometimes we think we know best on what people need. And I've learned over time is to ask because they know best first. And at the very least, if they don't know because it's a child and maybe they're not as articulate and they can't say exactly what they need, or if people are, you know, doing this type of practice and they've never actually asked themselves what they need, that they couldn't answer it, then just really to validate and give so much love and compassion. That's how I would speak to the child. But just letting you know, you're okay. I love you. You're safe. I'm here for you if you need me.
Now imagine if you said that to your fear.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm a facilitator. I don't actually, when I work with clients, give anybody any advice about what to do about fear. I've actually had to learn how to speak about it for like podcasts here. I had to learn how to write about it. But prior to writing my book or doing all these podcasts, all I would do is just broker conversations between a client and their fear. And then fear would then return, you know, you would say that to me, let's say I'm your fear. And then I in return would say something like, well, what I need from you is to be given some respect and consideration. I'm not so bad. You know, you've been mistreating me. And, you know, take me out of the basement. Give me some love, some consideration. Like, together we can be magnificent. But if you just keep me in the basement like this, I'm just going to continue to scream and yell and covertly run your life,
mm-hmm.
you know, in one way or another.
Or overtly sometimes. Something that we didn't mention that suppressing your emotions can do is cause severe health issues as well. So if you don't pay attention at some point, I mean, because that's what happened to me. I didn't realize, but there was old past like anger, anxiety, and depression that I didn't address, and it erupted in some crazy health issues for me. And that's when I had to lean in and do even more of this work that you're talking about to explore and see what parts of myself needed more love, needed more attention, needed to express, you know, that part to know that it, one, has a voice and that it is loved and accepted and embraced by me instead of pushed down into the basement or ignored even, because I've done so much of this inner work. It's not like I still try to suppress or control or overcome things. I really been in the practice of loving, embracing, and accepting. But there are times when you don't even see when you're just actually ignoring a part that needs your love and attention. So, yeah.
What fear is an emotion that's supposed to flow into, through, and out of your body mm-hmm. in between 10 and 90 seconds. It actually proven by neuroscience, and it releases the cortisol and the adrenaline, all those, you know, chemicals, and then it's gone. And like picture yourself like a hose, and you know, here it comes through into and out of your system. And then if you, and it's supposed to kind of help you sharpen up and bring your A game to everything you do. But if you see it and you wish it weren't so, like, I don't want to feel this, then all of a sudden hose becomes kinked, it becomes backed up, and it's just recirculating round and round and round. And what do we know about water that is stagnant? It becomes the ideal host environment for bacteria and viruses to thrive, or cancer, all of that. So in stopping the flow of your emotions, you actually create the ideal host environment in your body for illness to thrive.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's, you know, it's really, really important, especially if somebody has like a predisposition to Parkinson's or rheumatoid arthritis or Alzheimer's, to be in flow with your emotions so that you don't create an ideal host environment such that these genetically possibly predisposed diseases may be triggered,
mm-hmm.
you know, become permanent. Right.
Yeah.
Or yeah, it's cancer. You know, you don't want to create the ideal host environment for cancer to thrive. It's mm-hmm. really important work as a result.
Yeah.
So back to fear practice. So it starts with just having a conversation with your fear, and it just starts with basically waking up, like raising your antenna. Like, what is my deal with fear? And fear is the big one.
Mm-hmm.
Beneath anger is fear. Like, oftentimes people feel like, oh, I have an anger issue. Well, 95% of what we know as modern anger is actually repressed fear.
Mm.
Because people would rather feel angry because it feels more powerful than fear.
Or hurt, yeah.
Right. Also, sadness. oftentimes is repression of fear, you know, because we don't want to feel angry because that feels rude. We feel sadness. Like all the emotions are so tied together. You know, if we have a fear practice, then it oftentimes had an influence on your anger and sadness levels. So anyway, so just raise your antenna. Like I had a sat radio that I brought into the mountains once and it didn't work. I brought the thing back. I'm like, damn thing doesn't work. Tried to return it. And they said, well, did you raise the antenna?
Like, oh, that thing?
That thing. And so if you don't have an awareness practice around this, your life is just static. You don't know what's going on. So you got to have an awareness practice. Oh, you know, what is my relationship with fear? That's what I help broker for people. Mm-hmm. And then you change your language around fear. And then the third thing is that you learn how to feel it instead of think about it. And this is really, really hard for people because in our society, you know, the intellect is king. You know, we like worship our intellect to understand things, to analyze things like a god. We built a shrine to it. We think that it's going to solve all our problems. And so we're dealing with our emotions, therefore, intellectually. Remember, I was talking about emotional intelligence is seen as our ability to understand our emotions, which is ridiculous, and control them, which is also ridiculous. Like, we're not going to be able to understand fear, and we're not going to be able to control it. So instead, emotional intelligence for me is our ability to feel our emotions in an honest way. And where that happens is in our bodies. And so right now, just go inward and just close your eyes. I'm going to help you do this. I'm going to help us all do it. I want you to locate where fear is in your body right now. And don't get too caught up on the word fear. Because mostly what people perceive as being fear is actually their resistance to the fear. It's the thought and the feeling like, I don't want to feel this. You know, that's the uncomfortable feeling that we associate with fear. So just locate any kind of discomfort in your body. It may feel like anger. It may feel like anxiety. It may feel like stress. It may feel like sadness. And tell me, what do you feel? And tell me, where do you feel it? Like for me, I feel stress and it's in my throat and chest. What do you feel?
Mine is also in my chest, like a heaviness on my chest. And sometimes I can feel that sensation right above my solar plexus and right underneath my heart. So like a spot right in between there.
And notice how strong is it right now? You know, we're doing a podcast and we don't want to say something stupid. I don't want to talk too much.
It's actually okay if you say something stupid. I've got an editor who will cut it out. So we're fine. I don't care what we say on here.
But we've also done a lot of podcasts. No. So yeah. On a scale of 1 to 10, 10 being strong, for me, it feels about a level 3. How about you?
I'm at like a 1, 2. I don't really feel it too much. I mean, when I think about it and I was putting intention earlier, I was able to locate it. But actually the sensation right now, if I'm just wanting to feel it, it's maybe 1, 2.
Okay. So here's the next step. This is a big moment. You ready for this? Everybody should get out a pen. Suffering equals discomfort times resistance. So discomfort is normal. Like we're going to feel discomfort. Life is an uncomfortable experience. It's a scary experience. Remember, it's your hardware. We feel fear all the time. It's very, very difficult to lower that number. So let's say the number is for me a 3. What is your resistance to that? Like, I don't want to feel this. You know, I wish this weren't so. You know, how strong is that? And maybe not in this moment, but like think of a time that you were super anxious. Like how strong was your level of resistance to that? Like,
Sometimes at a 10.
Oh yeah.
Ugh. Yeah. And it's painful when that resistance is so high. Yeah. Massive suffering.
Right. So Jaquetta, my client, her level of discomfort was a level 10. Her level of resistance to that discomfort, I don't want to feel this. I need to win this war against it, was also a level 10. Ooh. So 10 times 10, that's a whole lot of suffering. Mm-hmm. So the the resistance is actually taught in our society. The discomfort is innate. That's just part of life. Life is a scary experience, right? We're on this little blue marble hurling through space. The lizard brain thinks everything's a threat, right? It's going to be high. But the resistance to that is taught. You know, we're taught to conquer it or overcome it, you know, get rid of it, tap it away, deep breath it away. You know, I don't want to feel this. I don't want to feel this. There's something wrong with me. It's a sign of personal weakness. Mom thinks that I shouldn't be feeling this, on and on. Like, we're taught this. We need to unlearn that. So like with Jaquetta, I got her to lower her resistance to it. You know, she still had a level of 10 discomfort, but her resistance is now a 1. 10 times the 1 is now a whole lot less suffering.
A whole lot less suffering.
Right. Right. And she even has found a way to have the discomfort kind of help her come alive.
Ooh.
Yeah.
That's powerful.
So I'm going to, yeah, it is powerful. So I'm going to finish my emotional intelligence definition. Emotional intelligence, right? Everybody write this down. Is our ability to feel our emotions in an honest way, which we're going to do in a second, and have them help us come alive.
Mm-hmm.
So here's the step where we feel our emotions. So close your eyes again. And especially I want you to feel any negativity and feel any pain, emotional pain, even physical pain. There's an emotional component to it that maybe you don't want to deal with. So spend, like, let's do 30 seconds right now. I like at least a minute, up to 10 minutes, just feeling it. And now this is hard for people to do because they start to think about what that means, or they start to think about a time in the past or whatever that they did this and they tried to recreate that. Like, I only want us to be in this moment right now, and there is no thought. This is a thought-free experience. It's just you feeling your discomfort. And the key being, you do this without trying to get rid of it. 30 seconds in silence. Okay, what is that like for you?
I mean, it's uncomfortable, but it's completely bearable. I think I was maybe at a 5 of feeling something. I was thinking of an incident in the past that I had felt fear, and so that allowed it to trigger up, but I was at a 5, and then I was just letting it be. Yeah.
So what you just said means that you were in your head and you were trying to conjure up a past situation.
Well, because I wasn't feeling anything currently. That's right. Why I haven't felt anything. So I was like, okay, let's bring it up. But then the moment I thought of the thought and I felt the feeling, I just focused on the sensation in my body. So I wasn't thinking it the whole time, but I used something to trigger a feeling in my body that then I was just feeling the sensation.
Okay. So some tweaks on this.
Yes.
Like I'm looking for words, like the words that you use, I'm focusing on it, which means that your mind was maybe focusing on it.
Okay.
You know, maybe it's more of an organic experience to just completely put the mind aside.
Mm-hmm. Well, I felt a tightness in my chest,
mm-hmm.
the heaviness. I felt my breathing constricting a bit. Mm-hmm. I felt my shoulders tense also. And those were the main sensations. I felt myself also wanting to take deep breaths because my breath was so shallow. It was extremely uncomfortable. So I wanted to re-regulate that with deeper breaths. But mm-hmm. And that's actually usually how I process emotions. Normally, that's probably why naturally my body wanted to do that as well. But I was just letting the tightness be there and just being with the tightness.
So the one thing, like I said, that gets in our way is we put our minds on the job. And I can see you in a very analytical state. And people that are really, really intelligent have a hard time doing this. So that's a compliment. And it took me a really long time to have an experience of just feeling my emotions without having my mind involved, or trying to conjure up something from the past or artificially create an uncomfortable feeling. So the goal is in this, with a fear practice, is just to feel whatever discomfort is there in this moment. And yours was very low. It was a level one. And what tends to happen is, you know, I'll give you an example. I was about to give a very high profile speech in front of a big time audience earlier this year. And, you know, I'm learning to give speeches, but it's not my forte. I'm more of a facilitator. And I'm lecturing about fear and anxiety. And I'm about to go on stage and I'm freaking out, right? And it's 15 minutes before going out there, and I'm looking out the window, you know, behind the curtain, and I'm like, oh my gosh. So fortunately, I know what to do. So I went back behind the building. I left the building. I went outside and I did this for 2 minutes. The first thing I did was acknowledge that it was normal and natural for me to feel fear and anxiety. I'm about to give a speech. It's an important audience. That's the first step. The second step, I noticed what I was feeling in my body, and it was anxiety, and it was all over my chest and throat, and it was a level 10. And then I noticed my reaction to it. I didn't want to feel it. And I was kind of in the mindset of, I don't want to be here. I don't want to do this. I'm terrified. I don't want to feel this terror. I just want to be home. I just want to be with my husband, watching a movie, petting the cat. Like, I do not want to be here. I do not want to do this. So I was 10 times 10. I was a whole lot of suffering. And then what I did is I spent, because the resistance was actually felt stronger than even the discomfort itself, I spent a minute just feeling my resistance, just repeating over and over again, I don't want to be here. I don't want to be here. I don't want to do this. I don't want to do this, which is very different. I mean, I don't know anybody else that's taught this. I looked. And the thing is, whatever you won't look at is the key to freedom. So I just felt that feeling of, I don't want to feel this, for 1 minute. And it started to dissipate. It's kind of like a whining child that's trying to get your attention.
But isn't that being in your head?
No, I was just in my body.
But if you're thinking, I don't want to feel it, I don't want to feel it, I don't want to feel it, isn't that also a cognitive thing?
There's a difference. It wasn't in my head. It was in my body. I was feeling it. Like, I don't want to be here. I was saying it over and over again, but I was feeling the kind of, like, I had my hands out. I had my body engaged. I was sweating. I was like, oh, you know, it was a feeling that I was feeling. Okay. I wasn't thinking it. I was in my body.
Okay.
And, you know, it was a feeling. It was showing up as a feeling that I was giving my undivided attention. And when you give a whining child your undivided attention, anybody that has kids know that if you ignore a whining child, you know, they keep whining louder and louder, or they leave and they come back later and they're really upset. But if you turn towards them and give them that kind of attention, they calm right down. So first my resistance calmed down, and then I just felt the discomfort without trying to get rid of it. And it calmed down. They both calmed down to about a level one. And then I went on stage and I didn't have any more worry. And it took me 2 minutes.
Awesome. We love 2 minutes.
Yeah. But prior to all of this, if I had to give a speech back in my 20s, I would go out and I would try to rationalize the fear away, replace it with calm. I'd do tapping. I'd take deep breaths. I'd be like, okay, you got this. You got this. Like, I would do that, and it works, but it's a lot of effort, and it's done at the repression of the fear rather than the inclusion of it.
So can we run through this really quick? And I'm so bummed because we're pretty much at time. So I want to make sure people have very clear steps on this fear practice that they can start developing for themselves, so they can essentially free themselves of the pain and the suffering.
Right.
Can you just quickly run through what are the steps that they can do to cultivate? Because you've said it, but just... And I can pick it up, but I just, if we can give a really clear pathway.
Okay. Big picture, raise your antenna, become aware of your relationship with fear. Second, change your language. Stop using combative, dismissive, abusive language towards fear. And then what I outlined, I didn't call it this before, but it's the 4-step art of fear method. And the first step, which I do for about 15 seconds, just acknowledge it's normal and natural to feel discomfort. It's part of life. It's not a character flaw. It's not a sign of personal weakness. Second step is to do a body scan. You know, get out of your head. These next three steps have nothing to do with thinking. And just notice, what do I feel? Where do I feel it? And how strong is it? And even answering 1 to 10, how strong is it? It takes us back into our heads because we're searching for an answer. So just locate any kind of sensation of discomfort in your body. Fear has something to do with it, even if it's physical. Step three, notice your resistance to it. And this is really, really important. Your resistance to it, like, I don't want to feel this, is probably the awful feeling that you associate with fear. It's probably the worst feeling. And for a lot of people, it's stronger than even the discomfort itself. And then the fourth step is you spend some time feeling these, and don't try to get in your head and try to understand what that means. This is really simple. It's like, you know, when you touch the fur of a kitten, you know, are you in the head saying, what does this mean? Mm-hmm. Oh, I got to remember a time that I touched the fur of a kitten before to really experience this, you know. Mm-hmm. No, it's just in the moment, and you just feel it like a rider feels a horse. And spend anywhere from 1 to 10 minutes. If you're new at this, it may take longer. And the key is you do this without trying to get rid of it. And the feeling will dissipate, much like a whining child that gets
your 10 to 90 seconds or 2 minutes.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And that's just the first part. You know, that's just how to kind of start down the course of resolving a repression of fear related problem. You know, what I talked about in my ski career, where you then become intimate with the fear and it takes you into higher states of awareness and consciousness and motivates you and all of that. That's like, you know, fear 501.
And that's next level Zen.
That's next level, you know, and, but at least start there. You know, that's plenty to work with just to end the war that it's being carried out in your unconscious mind against fear, which is a war against yourself. Mm-hmm. And make friends with it, you know, and what happens after war is over? Peace.
Yeah. Whatever that saying, right? Which is true. Whatever we resist persists. And I say, whatever you love, embrace, and accept, you stop resisting. You actually do create that peace and love and everything else that we truly desire in our life. So beautiful. Well, Kristen, to close this out, I've got three questions for you that I ask all my guests. The first is this. What's something unique about you that most people don't know?
I've never lost a handstand competition.
Never?
I challenged Nadia Comaneci to one once, but we were in evening gowns.
What?
And, amazing. And I said, I would challenge you to a handstand contest, but, you know, we're in evening gowns. So, and she's like, yes, we go right here, right now.
And did you win?
No, we didn't do it.
And how many handstand competitions have you been in?
Oh, maybe 20.
That's a really good record. when you're in a really dark place, what's your go-to to get out?
A fear practice, 100% of the time. It works every time, and it's super fast.
Beautiful. And knowing what you know now, what advice would you give your 10-year-old self?
This is going to be counter to what most people hear. Care more about what people think of you.
Say more about that one.
Well, I was reading a magazine the other day, and it was some lady, she's a Hollywood actress, and you know what, the same question was asked her, and she said, care less about what other people think of you. I'm like, I think that I need to care more about what other people think of me, because, you know, I have no filter. And whatever's in my mind comes right out my mouth. And I have just like it's Burning Man. Okay, great. But I live in Utah. Like, think about that. So I need to be a little bit more conscientious of other people's come from, that they're not always up for the direct approach. And so I'm learning in my 50s to care more about what other people think of me. So as to monitor my filter.
I love that. I love how specific it was to you, like what you would tell your 10-year-old, because some of the answers are always or more universal. And you're just like, no, for my 10-year-old, I'd tell her to care
more. The exact
more.
Opposite of what everybody else.
I mean, there was one, my friend Light, I interviewed him and his was hilarious because I said, what would you tell your 10-year-old self? And he said, lock the door, because he was recreating a Prince video, buck naked in like purple sequin boots, crawling on the floor, and his mother walked in. So he said the advice he would give his 10-year-old self is lock the door.
That's a great answer.
It's so good. Kristen, it has been an absolute pleasure having you on the show. Thank you again for doing a part two series of recording with me so we can make sure that we get you on the show to share who you are yourself, as well as this incredible wisdom and knowledge that you've accumulated and created and that you're sharing with the world in such a powerful way. So thank you so very much.
And if somebody feels intimidated about this and thinks, oh, well, how, I know I repress fear. I know it's hurting me. And you just don't even with this podcast, know where to start. Please give me a call. I'm here to help.
And grab your book.
Yeah. And it's not as hard as you imagine it to be. And things change and they change fast.
Beautiful. Thank you so much.
I love it. I really love how Kristen shared that fear is simply a sensation felt in the body, and that fear is a large part of who we are, and how we treat our fear is how we treat ourselves. And as Kristen said, when we stop hating fear, we stop abusing ourselves. I mean, that is so good. And you guys, this is shadow work, you know, which is so important to our mental, emotional, and spiritual well-being. And shadow work is facing those parts of ourselves that we'd rather shove in a box and pretend they didn't exist. And it's facing and being loving with our deepest wounds. You know, the wounds that have us believing that we're flawed, that we're unlovable or undeserving people, which of course is so not true. Because when we do face off with our fears in a loving way, and we do that shadow work and create a healthier and more loving relationship with our fear, it allows us to live from a place of wholeness and expansion. Now, one of the pathways to develop a more loving relationship with fear, and of course, with yourself, is through self-love. So if this is something you want support with, I wanna hook you up. I've created a free self-love gift, and it's a kickstart that will give you some practical and powerful practices that you can do to get you on your journey to increasing your self-awareness and compassion with yourself as any doubts, fears, or judgments come up. And it'll guide you to own your worth so that you can radically transform your life. Now, you can download that free self-love gift that I created just for you at stephaniekwong.com/self-love-kickstart. Now, if there's someone that you know who could benefit from this episode, pretty please share it with them. Also, if you got value from this episode and you want more, I would love for you to subscribe to the podcast. And of course, if it feels aligned, I would be deeply grateful if you'd leave a 5-star review on iTunes, because that means we can support even more people to rise higher together. And finally, for everything that we mentioned in today's episode and for all the links to connect with Kristen, you can check them out in the show notes, and that's over at stephaniekwong.com/EP28. And of course, you can check out all my other podcast episodes there too. Okay, guys, until next time, I'm sending you so much love.